Good afternoon. My name is Brianne Hardman, registration number 37922. I represent Chad Coughlin. Today I want to discuss issue 2 in the briefs, but I'd be glad to answer questions about the other issues, any one of which warrants reversal of Mr. Coughlin's convictions. In this case, the prosecutor repeatedly asked Roy Nelson, Mr. Coughlin's co-defendant, about the condition in his plea agreement that he testify, that required him to testify truthfully. On direct examination, the prosecutor asked Nelson 7 times about that condition. For example, he asked, was it a condition on certain things you had to do? What are those things? Mr. Nelson replied, to testify honestly. On redirect, the prosecution asked another 3 times about the truthfulness of Nelson's testimony. For example, he said, if you were to lie about what happened, is that something you would expect us to figure out? Do you think we can tell? You think we would be able to tell if you're not truthful? Mr. Nelson replied, yes. The court then did not instruct the jury on the proper use of felony convictions or co-defendant guilty pleas in its jury instructions.
Ms. Hardman, before you proceed, what do you propose, or how do you propose that the jury be advised of a plea bargain? I mean, sooner or later, they're going to know that there's been a plea entered.
Right. They should be instructed that they should use the plea agreement only to determine the co-defendant witness's credibility and not as substantive evidence of the defendant's guilt. And that's discussed in...
And I'm talking about the truthfulness component. I mean, shouldn't the jury know what the terms and conditions of the plea are?
Right. And this court held in People v. Richelli that the prosecution may introduce the co-defendant's guilty plea and the condition that he testify truthfully. However, he can do so only under narrow circumstances. He may not appear to express personal opinion about the co-defendant's credibility, and he may not appear to possess information unknown to the jury. Here, the prosecutor went what was beyond what was allowed in People v. Richelli. Here, the prosecutor appeared to express his personal opinion about Nelson's credibility.
And where?
Well, first he did so by repeatedly asking about the truthfulness. Are you testifying truthfully? Yes.
Isn't that just maybe inartful questioning as opposed to saying...
It's improper vouching. And then he did so...
What case supports that? I mean, there was nothing in the language that the prosecutor used that would have vouched for the witness. So what is it that... In those questions, in the repeated questions about the plea agreement itself,
in the first questions,
that constituted
vouching. The repeated nature. He should not be repeating it over and over and disproportionately emphasizing it. But then on redirect, he did so especially by saying, don't you think, by using the first person, is how it's phrased in one of the cases that I cite, by saying, don't you think we'll know? If you were to lie about what happened, is that something you would expect us to figure out? Do you think we can tell? Do you think we will be able to tell if you're not being truthful? And so first he did so by just repeatedly, another case that I cite refers to it as prosecution overkill, over and over asking about it. But then he did so, especially on redirect, by using the words we and us. It's similar to a case from our Supreme Court called People, Domingo Gomez versus People, which happened in closing argument, that the prosecutor referred to a screening process that they had before, they used before deciding to prosecute a case. And the Supreme Court found that that reference both inferred personal opinion and expressed information unknown to the jury. Whatever line Richelli draws, it was certainly crossed here. If the prosecutor is going to introduce the condition that the co-defendant testify truthfully, he should do so on redirect when it mitigates the vouching nature of that testimony. and he should not disproportionately emphasize the condition. And third, the court should instruct the jury on the proper use of that information. And here, the prosecutor began to vouch for Nelson's credibility on direct examination before his credibility had been attacked. The prosecutor referred to this condition 10 times over and over again in Nelson's testimony, and the court failed to instruct the jury on either the proper use of felony convictions of a witness or use of the co-defendant's guilty plea.
But the case that the prosecutor never mentioned at one time in closing argument.
The prosecutor heavily relied on Nelson's testimony in closing
argument. Did he ever refer to the agreement and say, you can believe this guy because of the plea agreement?
He did not refer to the plea agreement in closing argument. And I know the example I just gave, Dominguez-Gomez, is in closing argument. And some of the cases that we cite in our briefs are during testimony. Some are talk about it being referred to in closing argument. But I think the jury's instructed that closing argument isn't evidence. It's what the testimonies say or what the witnesses say when they're on the stand. That's evidence. And here it was over and over again brought in that this condition was that he testify truthfully. Not only that he testified truthfully, but that he was going to prison for 43 years if he were to not testify truthfully, and that the prosecutor would know and be able to and would enforce that agreement if they believed he was not testifying truthfully.
I thought you just mentioned a moment ago about the special instruction concerning the effect of a felony on the juror on a witness's credibility.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, that instruction wasn't given. But the parties didn't tender it to the court. But did the court tell the parties they could properly argue that to the jury in the absence of an instruction if they stated the law correctly?
The court did say that, but it's not the same as the court instructing the jury. In fact, I think the juries are routinely instructed what the attorneys say about the law is their argument, but my instructions are what control your decision here.
But if the parties didn't choose to make that argument, why is there any harm?
Well, what basis did they have to argue it if the jury was not instructed on it?
Their basis was that the court specifically allowed them to do that.
But the jury was not going to be instructed on it, and they were told my instructions are the law and what the attorneys say is just argument. This error was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Which error are you talking about right now?
I'm sorry, we're talking about
the vouching issue. Okay.
The vouching. It was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Nelson's testimony and credibility were critical to the state's case. Nelson's testimony was the most critical to undermining Mr. Coughlin's defense of others and self-defense, and to convicting Mr. Coughlin. He testified that Mr. Coughlin became angry as he approached the car, that he asked for Nelson's knife, and that he didn't see any physical contact between Natalie Warling and Tony Sample before Mr. Coughlin approached. The prosecution relied on Nelson's testimony and closing argument over and over again several times to both establish the mens rea element and to discredit the defense of others and self-defense. The court failed to instruct on felony convictions and use of guilty pleas, as we've discussed, and the court also failed to instruct on the self-defense principle of no duty to retreat, which in combination with these other errors undermined Mr. Coughlin's right to act in self-defense.
At what point in the encounter do you contend that that duty to retreat was implicated, was raised?
The circumstances of this case bring no duty to retreat into play, in that it's happening in a wide open area out in the public. There's plenty of opportunity for Mr. Coughlin to retreat, to run away, instead of acting in Warling's defense and in his own self-defense. And so the circumstances here raise
But at what point? I mean, what specific action?
You could say, well, he should have retreated instead of coming to Worling's defense, or he should have retreated once he stepped in and then Mr. Sample began, pinned him to the ground, I guess, sometime between being pinned and when Mr. Sample then began to beat up Mr. Coughlin, he should have run away instead of acting in his self-defense. And the jurors in voir dire expressed that that was their belief. And the court's failure to instruct on that is also not harmless error.
Well, let me probe that a little bit. Because as I understood, the main theory of defense was, on self-defense, was that the defendant didn't stab the person in the car, that he went over,
right.
He went over there, he was attacked by the guy, he's on the ground, and that's when he starts stabbing him.
When he starts flailing his arms, so, as Tony Sample is punching him.
Right, and he's on the ground. He's lying on the ground. So in that, under that theory of defense, how is a jury reasonably even going to think about retreat at that point? The question would be, did he use reasonable force, not whether he was going to retreat or not. And the same with his alternate defense was, I take it, I wanted to protect my girlfriend. And so if that's the theory of defense, how does retreat even enter into that?
Because he could have retreated before doing either. He didn't have to walk over there. When he realized what was going to happen, he could have backed off, and he didn't do so, is what the jury could have believed.
How was that consistent with his theory of the case, though? Because his theory wasn't that he could have walked away. His theory was that...
Right, yeah, his theory was I can act in self-defense or defense of Ms. Worling.
I would, under his theories, though, why would a jury even think about retreat? It didn't seem to make any sense to me. I mean, retreat wouldn't have even been an issue under those circumstances.
There was an opportunity for him to have retreated.
Did the prosecution argue that? I didn't see it anywhere in the closing.
Not in the closing, but it was discussed in voir dire that the jurors believed that.
Which jurors?
I will look. I will reserve the remaining time for rebuttal, and I'll look while that attorney general is talking. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the court. John Lee on behalf of the people, bar number 38141. When presenting an accomplice's testimony at trial, prosecutors may elicit testimony during direct regarding the provisions of a witness's plea agreement requiring truthful testimony. Under that standard for admissibility articulated by this court in Bruner and Richelli, the prosecutor's questions in this case were not inappropriate. Now, I think the defendant's arguments can be separated into two different challenges. We have the first grouping, which are the statements in direct regarding the witness's understanding of the word truthful, and then we have the second question in redirect regarding whether the witness thought the people knew he was testifying truthfully. Starting with the first, this court has already held that a prosecutor can admit evidence that as a condition of an accomplice's agreement, he had to testify truthfully. And there's just simply no basis for carving out an exception preventing the people from establishing what the witness believes that condition requires. That's what gives meaning to the condition in the first place. No cases cited in the brief stand for that the defendant's proposition, and such a holding would be flatly inconsistent with the law that we have, which provide that if the evidence helps the jury assess the witness's credibility, it should come in. And of course, whether a witness believes that the conditions or how the witness understands conditions, of course, they'll only enhance the jury's understanding of the agreements. Turning to the second claim, that the prosecutor's questions in redirect were improper, I think there are three problems with the defendant's argument. First, the statement was not inappropriate. Two, if it was, the defendant opened the door. And three, there was no harm. In regards to the appropriateness of the comments, whether the witness believes that he needs to abide by the agreement, to me, is just the same thing as admitting evidence of agreement in the first place. There's no practical difference between the two kinds of evidence. And that's why I think this case is not at all tantamount to the Roberts and the Brown case that the defendant cites, which dealt with evidence actually outside of the record, where they said that there was polygraph people in the outside the court who were verifying the accomplice's testimony. Certainly, I do not think this case rises to that level, and the comments were not inappropriate. As far as opening the door goes, I think if we look at the statements in context, in direct, we only admitted evidence that an agreement had been reached, and one of the conditions was that the accomplice had to testify truthfully. It wasn't until redirect, or into cross-examination, that the defense brought out that the agreement could be revoked if the defendant, if the accomplice did not testify against the defendant. Once that came out, I think the prosecution was entitled to admit evidence establishing under what circumstances the agreement would be rescinded. It wasn't that it'd be rescinded if he didn't testify, but if he didn't testify truthfully. So I definitely think that to the extent there's any impropriety in the question, the defense's cross-examination certainly opened the door. And finally, any error in admitting it was harmless, as some of this court's questions have already revealed. Although given an opportunity to discuss this issue during closing, the defense opted not to, which I think severely discounts their claim of prejudice. Also, I don't know exactly what this would have added to the defendant's case. And if the court has no questions on that, I'll turn to the jury instruction. I think the defendant's argument just ignores this court's holding in Montalvo Lopez that held that a court does not commit plain error when it doesn't give instructions sua sponte. I think it's well established in this jurisdiction that a court does not need to give a limiting instruction unless the defendant requests it. As they did not request it in this case, I think it's axiomatic that it's not plain error. Certainly, it would not be obvious for a court not to give it when there's existing case law saying that a court does not need to give an instruction sua sponte.
What's your position with regard to whether when the duty to retreat was implicated, was raised in terms of, you know, what facts would have raised that issue or not?
Our position certainly is the facts here did not raise it. And Cassell says that the instruction should only be given when the jury could reasonably infer that the defendant had duty to retreat. Under both theories of defense, the instruction was inappropriate here. For whether the initial attack where he was supposedly protecting his girlfriend, I don't think a reasonable jury would have thought that he should have just run away rather than coming to her aid.
Did the prosecution argue, you know, aside from any voir dire questioning, did the prosecution argue that, you know, he should have just gone away instead of going to her defense?
No, our claim all along was, one, he was not acting in self-defense, and two, if he was, the force he used by stabbing in the neck was unreasonable and he wasn't entitled to the defense. Also, just to finish up on that question, under the second theory of defense, the slashing, why the victim was on top of the defendant, again, the jury certainly would not have thought the defendant could have started running away from his back if they believed the story. So certainly, the duty to retreat just was not invoked under the facts of this case. I also think it's an important distinction to make that unlike the cases that have held that a no duty to retreat instruction should be given, this case did not involve the use of deadly physical force. As this court is aware, in those cases, the jury is given an explicit instruction saying that the defendant's self-defense is only excused if a lesser degree of force is inadequate. So under that instruction, they're forced to explicitly consider whether or not the defendant could have taken any other reasonable grounds. In this case, instruction was just, we couldn't disprove that the defendant was using reasonable force from what he reasonably believed was an unlawful imminent attack. He was entitled to the defense. So certainly, I think that our defendant's argument reads the word reasonable too narrow, because the jury would not have concluded that we had to prove that he did the most reasonable ground. It was just if he took any reasonable ground, his force was justified. And third, it's certainly any error in not giving the instruction was harmless, given that just there was no evidence in this case supporting that the defendant had duty to retreat. And I think this court looks at the closing argument. This case really turned on whether or not the defendant stabbed the victim in the neck. Because it was certainly our position that if he did, then that was unreasonable force and he's not acting in self-defense. And closing arguments focused on that issue, and that's completely aside from the duty to retreat point. So this court is no further questions. That is true, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Ms. Hardman, you've got 2 minutes and 35 seconds.
I don't have the jurors' names who in voir dire expressed that they would expect a no duty to retreat, but the pages that I cited in my opening brief where you'll find this is on January 28th, pages 80, 92, 93, and 147.
What's the relevant, even if that's the case, what's the relevance of statements in voir dire if
there was nothing argued about duty to retreat at trial itself.
Because the evidence raised the question of retreat. And so because he was, there was evidence he was not the initial aggressor, he was entitled to that instruction. Here, the question should not be broken up into two groups. It's all part of the prosecutor's overarching vouching for Nelson's credibility, which was very crucial to their case. They bolstered Nelson's credibility. He was the most important witness for undermining the defense of others and self-defense. The questions were inappropriate, even under Richelli. Whatever line Richelli draws, this definitely crossed it. It inferred both personal opinion of Nelson's credibility and outside knowledge unknown to the jury that he was telling the truth. I do cite cases that it should not be repeated. That's Halbert and Chiampa. And I do not ignore Montalvo Lopez. There was no meaningful analysis in Montalvo Lopez about why it was not plain error. I do discuss Bruner because there is analysis in that case, a plain error analysis about why it did not constitute plain error there. Plain error is a case-by-case determination. It's not just a blanket. It's never a plain error. I believe those were the only points I wanted to talk about from the Attorney General's argument. But we didn't open the door because Richelli allows this testimony because it assumes that the defendant is going to cross-examine on the plea agreement. That's why it's allowed. But Richelli does not allow the prosecutor to express their personal opinion or to infer facts outside the jury's knowledge. Therefore, we would, I'm sorry.
Your time is up, Ms.
Right. We would ask that you please reverse Mr. Coughlin's convictions.
Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments. The case will stand submitted. An opinion will issue in due course.